Here's what you can look forward to in today's episode.
In the early days, we had no idea about market research. So we were very naive going into that market. And actually, I believe that turned out to be a plus and a benefit of doing so.
Over the last decade, the market research industry has been disrupted. Our largest agencies are struggling to keep up as their customers turn to newer, faster, and cheaper data sources. Now, we are on the edge of yet another major market shift. Now is the time for us to reassert ourselves as the rudder of the brands we love. Thank you for tuning in to the Happy Market Research Podcast, where we are charting the path for the future of market researchers and businesses. You're listening to the Happy Market Research Podcast. Today, my guest is John Papadakis, CEO and founder of Pollfish. Pollfish is a survey platform with a unique approach to sampling designed to improve data quality and speed to insights. Prior to founding Pollfish, John has worked in technology, developing a platform that made building Android apps easy. John, thanks very much for being on the Happy Market Research Podcast today.
Thank you so much for your time and for inviting me.
I'd like to start out with this marquee question of ours. Tell us a little bit about your parents and how they have affected your career.
Right. So first, if you know some background, I'm Greek. I was born in Athens, Greece, and then moved to Germany until I was 5 years old, and then ended up to a small town 1 hour away from Athens. Both my parents are retired now, but they were elementary school teachers. So for the first 3 years of my life in the elementary school, they happened to be my teachers as well. And 20 years ago, being a teacher in a small town in Greece, it's something that was a very respectful role for the local community. So what I grew up in an environment that my parents were really respectful to the community and the other way around. And especially my father was very diligent. He would not have any task, undone. He was a very responsible person and still is. So I take that one of the key things that I took away and my parents from my parents is the, being diligent and being consistent. The other thing is that my father was also leading that school. So he was running a small business. I didn't understand that at the time, but I now, seeing back, I he was handling a proper P&L and having employees. So it's maybe some of the, that background passed on to me. The most important one is that they were teachers. So one of the main responsibilities was to understand the kids. So I had, infinite, moral and financial support from them to follow on my crazy dreams. Maybe that's one of the most important thing. But I'll tell you what, there was one thing that I didn't learn from them, and it's teaching. I'm notoriously bad at teaching, especially people that don't want to be taught. I had some takeaways and some things and perks didn't pass on.
Things sometimes didn't stick. I think all of us have some of those good and bad characteristics, thankfully, that maybe we didn't carry over from our childhood. So supportive, it sounds like that was a central theme with your parents. And you've had and we're going to get into the details in a minute, a background of entrepreneurship, of course. With respect to your father and his intent of, was he a principal? Did he start the school? Did he?
He was a principal. He was leading. He was leading the school at the very last years of his career.
Interesting. Then, what brought you out of Greece?
I only recently, flew out for the first time to follow my dreams and my career. And that was the, Pollfish. I flew out of Greece the first, the second year that Pollfish was founded. Until then, I was in Greece, Greek-only ecosystem and doing some technology stuff back then.
So you recognize that Greece wasn't the best environment for you to be able to create this technology startup. And did you immediately go to New York?
No. So first of all, Greece on its own is not a good ecosystem to grow a business. So you can grow a local business, of course, you have access to, you know, the local market and local talent. But on the very early days with Polphis, all of our clients were from, especially in the, from the States. The first time I came to the US, I think was 2015, and I flew to San Francisco. You know, I was staying in one of those houses with 25 people in one room. I loved it. And, you know, stayed there for a couple of, you know, but probably 6 months. We didn't manage to get any investors, any clients, any partnerships. So, you know, immediately we knew that, you know, San Francisco or the West Coast wasn't, you know, suited for us. And then, you know, we had started to get a lot of customers and partners from New York. So gradually I moved to New York as well and brought the big part of the business here.
So technology startups, thinking about this Silicon Valley, of course, I'll call it the heart of tech-based startups. I've got a lot of experience in that specific ecosystem. Why do you think you found traction inside of New York with New York investors versus Silicon Valley?
It's mostly with New York clients, and this is because a lot of research agencies are here, a lot of brands are here, and our product and market research and, you know, what we were selling at that time was really suited to agencies and consumer-facing brands, especially the marketing departments, and there are a lot of those in New York. In San Francisco, you have more technology companies, technology consumer-facing companies in the early days, and they may not be doing so much market research in the very early days, or they might rely more on the early adoption data rather than that going out to the market and ask people. We just didn't find a fit at that time.
So go to where the customers are. That's one of my rules in business. You always, you know, you don't expect customers to come to you. You go to where the customers are. And I mean that in a physical sense, obviously in a digital sense as well. You've got a lot of different types of companies, but you're right. Market research is in a lot of ways, East Coast to West Coast in terms of kind of like size, I think, with obviously some outliers in Hollywood, et cetera, but for sure.
I think that as well. And one other key factor is that I think, although I'm biased, that in New York, you find better talent in that specific sector because you have more experience here. More companies were, you know, in New York, in the East Coast or Connecticut, a lot of market research companies are here. So you have a lot of people with experience, you know, in market research as well.
So do you find that your customers in those early days, let me back up. How did you wind up getting your customers in the early days?
Right. I can tell you kind of the story of how we started, and that's very well related with this. So back in 2013, we had a few apps, some kind of popular applications for the Android and iOS devices. So we're very early days of the mobile apps back then. And we had quite a lot of users, but we couldn't make any money out of the advertising that we chose to monetize our apps with. Back in Greece as well, there were not many advertisers that, you know, wanted to advertise. And the only way to make more money was to include more ads, and we didn't want to do that. So we thought, what is the best way to get money, and monetize our content? And we came up with surveys. That was the origin story. And we created a survey platform that we incorporated into our own apps, and we launched the app and we updated the app. And we were running surveys, our own surveys, to see if our users would respond to that. And we were amazed by the response rate. So we took those results and we said, hey, we have, you know, 300,000 users, and we launched a survey and we got 3,000 responses in 2 hours. And we went to a local market research company and they said, all right, I'm going to try that. And this is when we actually formed the company. This is when we actually, you know, became a company. And so the first client was, you know, a kid that has nothing to do with market research, going to a market research, local market research store, and telling them, hey, I can do this. Do you want to buy? So that was the very first client and the origin story. After this, we, you know, went to LinkedIn groups and started, you know, creating a buzz around how we do market research and how we collect responses. And, you know, clients started to come. From the very beginning, all of our clients are self-served. So we didn't have any services or, you know, it was DIY from the very first day. So we started seeing customers from, you know, New York and India, especially mostly in East Coast, though. So it just came in.
So you quickly moved to a digital customer acquisition model. Is that correct?
Right. So the only non-digital acquisition model was the first sale. After this, was only that.
And that gave you, of course, the market proof that there was a product market fit in that context.
Right. However, the story is not that smooth, right? You know, so we very fast went into the market research space and started to get clients, but immediately we started to get a lot of interest into our product. But then we saw that our clients were seeing at that point that the way we collected data, because we're not operating as a panel, and the way we collect the data from the consumer being mobile only, not mobile first, mobile only, they consider poll office to be toy surveys, right? So they would be our customers, but not really. And we had to spend a lot of time and a lot of years actually to come to 2017, 2018, where, you know, mobile and, you know, other sampling methodologies are becoming the norm. But in the very early days, it was extremely difficult. We had the luxury and we're very happy to have supportive investors in the very early days that also believed in that vision. Otherwise, we would not be here. It took us a while to start making money.
Yeah, that's quite a while too. That it takes a lot of fortitude to stick with a startup, you know, for 3-4 years. Tell me a little bit about your experience or exposure to market research. Did you have an understanding of it, and or were you more like introduced to it as you found the consumer's interest in taking surveys on through your app?
Right. Now we have. In the early days, we had no idea about market research. So we were very naive going into that market. And actually, I believe that turned out to be a plus and a benefit of doing so. We came with a fresh set of eyes into a world that was very standardized. You know, you had the panels and you had people to get paid to respond to surveys, and you had surveys with 150, questions. And if we knew all those things before we started the company, we wouldn't start a company. There's no way we're going to start the company. So being naive and, you know, saying that, you know, we know mobile, we know people are there, and we see that, you know, our app's getting downloaded, you know, thousands of times a day. So people are in there. We're going to make an experience work for that, and we're going to put consumer first. We don't care about the customers for now, because they're going to change their mind. That's a very expensive and very luxury decision to make. And if we wouldn't fundraise, we couldn't make that. But luckily, we were naive enough and had the support of our investors to do those things and be where we are today.
How did you manage that relationship with your investors? I had to have to believe it was fairly tense in the early days.
Well, not really. Because if you think about it, we're a two-sided marketplace. We providing a way for the publishers to make money in a very nice way, in a user-engaging way. We take a lot of, you know, care about the user experience while doing so. And at the same time, we're looking for customers to use our services. Luckily, we were extremely successful in the first part, and we managed to train the market, and the market adapted into our mobile-first survey offering for monetization, and the numbers were amazing, and the adoption was great. So to be frank, you know, something was there. Everybody could see that. It just, you know, took us a while to go into the market and, you know, be on the right time that the clients will adopt such solution.
Yeah, and it's pretty indicative of market research. As you said, it's a we are an industry that is very steeped in tradition and approved methodologies, data collection approaches, et cetera, et cetera. And it is interesting. There is this J-curve effect I'm seeing in the tech space of the companies that can persist for 3 to 5 years. They hit this inflection, or the market hits an inflection point where all of a sudden they become considered norms, and right. Then the adoption just sucks up, right?
Right, but if they make the right choice. If they didn't, I mean...
No, I mean, you're right. You have to have the right bet the whole way through, but I think that it would be really easy for a lot of companies to pivot as opposed to stay the course in market research.
Right. And, I'm sure best that last year market research was extremely different as is today. And next year will be also extremely different. So the good thing is that it took a while, but now, the market is starting to adapt and is starting to try new things and actually acknowledge that there are, more things to collect sample, more things to get data, and how to actually make sense out of those all new technologies.
Right. Yeah. It's really an interesting time right now in market research. Is we've got questionable growth, and the majority of that growth is coming out of social based approaches, whether it's specifically social listening. Mobile first is something that we've talked a lot about, but I liked how you framed it, viewed as a toy. Certainly in the early days of mobile, that was the case. But now that brands are under this tremendous amount of pressure for performance, I think, mobile is where the consumers are. And just like you did, they're modeling their data collection approaches accordingly.
Right. And, looking to, the future, maybe the days of mobile phones are numbered. Market research needs to be mobile agnostic, really. It doesn't need to, marry formats or, just go where the customers are, and everybody will be happy at the end of the day.
So you had a company before you started Polefish, correct?
Correct, yes.
And that was it was an app that created apps, if I understand.
Right. Correct. It was an app that created apps.
Which is a freaking awesome idea, by the way. I love that conceptually.
Right.
Of course, did you wind up folding that into Polefish, or did you close that and was Polefish a new initiative?
So the second part, Polefish is a new initiative. However, there was a first company, again, going into the entrepreneurial a space without knowing anything about it. We had as a company a lot of great technology. We had great experiences. The company didn't end up going anywhere, but that was my first MBA. Essentially, I haven't done an MBA, so I think it was the experiences and the takeaways from that experience was so big of what is a company, how to create a company, how to, communicate with clients. All those things might seem very straightforward to people that run businesses, but if they take a step back and remember themselves before they do so, these are really a really good school to start a company. So for me, it's acted like an MBA. That was a great and amazing period of my life. And, ended up to be a failure as a business, but with a lot of takeaways.
What was one of your key takeaways in starting Polefish?
From the previous business?
Yeah. In other words, what was one of the key learnings from the previous business that helped you start and then ultimately scale Polefish?
Well, it provided a head start of, instead of learning all those things, you had some experience of how to do the first steps. And also, that was the major one. It will be very hard for me to just name one.
So you find it, you found a lot of value in, was it actually in like the starting of the company in terms of the formation of the entity, really what I consider to be more of the block and tackling of managing the bureaucracy? Was that one of the big takeaways?
you know, the difference was one of the main key differences in the beginning was that we started the last company without having any clients. We started Polyphase only when we had a client. You know, the small things, but, you know, maybe, you know, change of mindset and experience play a role. And I also think that those experiences play a role until today for me. I'm very, I love when technology enables business rather the other way around. But this is not always the case. And by looking at my previous experiences, that acts as a reminder as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So what is getting you really excited about the marketing research space right now?
It's changing. That's amazing. I don't like things that stay still. I like change. I don't like inertia. So to be honest, I'm fascinated to see how this will end up. And when I'm thinking about market research, I always see a lot of similarities with advertising space. So, you know, programmatic advertising, it took 10 years to form. It has the form that it has today. And I see that market research lags behind like 5 to 7 years, behind advertising. So I'm very curious and excited to see how market research landscape will evolve. What is the programmatic market research that everybody's saying today, but nobody really understands what it is because it's not defined yet? And how this, you know, the landscape will be in the next 3 years. I think that there's going to be a lot of specialization, not in the use cases as we have now, when we see companies doing, you know, specialization in, you know, healthcare or consumer insights, but more specialization in the functions. So we're going to have companies that are amazing and they've built technology, the best technology, they have the best people to communicate with the clients. And other companies that have the best fraud detection algorithms and the best user experiences, and all those companies working together. And this is when we will truly have a programmatic market research landscape. Right now, we're having baby steps, right? We're at the very early beginnings.
Do you think that's a framework for blockchain to thrive in, this research marketplace? When I think about the disparate pieces of a market research project, specifically, you know, there's a lot of logistics involved, right? Whether I use Polyphase or you pick the company, that's a piece of a piece of a piece. And do you think that blockchain-based marketplace would be really the framework that will see that technology thrive in market research?
Well, I don't think so. But at the same time, I own some coins, but I'm no expert in blockchain or their technology. But if I were to estimate that opportunity, I would take a look again in the advertising industry. Did the blockchain play a role in the advertising industry? Not yet, as far as I know of. I can see some, you know, applications regarding transparency and everybody, you know, having a ledger of who responded to what survey. So, you know, we have the best data. But the same thing can happen to the advertising industry as well, so that, you know, the one side knows what the other side is doing on any marketplace. So to be honest, I do not believe that in the next period, we're going to have blockchain playing a role, neither in advertising space, especially not in market research space. Maybe if coins become a really, you know, cost-effective way to reward people, maybe we will see some applications there. But that also applies to the advertising space as well. You have rewarding, you know, solutions and rewarding advertising units. So, again, I would first look in the advertising space before making any bet for the market research one.
I think it's super interesting using research as really advertising as the canary in the coal mine to dictate where we are going as an industry. And it makes perfect sense given that obviously that's the primary customer of marketing research.
I think it makes sense as well. I mean, as you said previously, you know, the companies are feeling the pressure to go on mobile. 5 years ago, they felt the pressure to advertise on mobile. It's, you know, at the end of the day, is where they're going to have find their consumers and where they're going to spend their money, here's where market research goes. But you know, we all know that market research moves slowly and things need to be proven before we, you know, do something. So that takes 5 to 7 years, maybe.
So coming out of a company that didn't do well, I've had a company incidentally that failed. It was called webconstruction.com. It was one of my very first startups. I did it in 1993, where I created websites for companies, and I wound up closing it. It was I could do the technology side of it really well. I just couldn't, it was ironic, I couldn't handle the accounts payable and accounts receivable side effectively. Right. So it's like really basic stuff that I was failing at. I could do the sales and the delivery side. Anyway, but it was a tough time for me, you know, closing that business and then taking a job for a few years, which, you know, thankfully worked out to be a blessing in disguise. How did you emotionally transition or maintain a highly positive perspective? Was that ever, you know, moving into Polefish, was that ever an issue for you?
Very interesting question, and it's not that hard. I mean, it was very natural. First of all, you know, we didn't have, you know, raised any money, or, you know, either for friends or family or VCs, or didn't have any clients that, you know, that were missed or we had, you know, responsibility against. So really it wasn't that big of an issue or that hard of a decision. And it's important to know that it was something that happened right after the university with no strings attached.
Got it.
And the thing that made it easier was that Polefish was right away. It was not, there was no period of doing nothing. It was, you know, here's Polefish, this business doesn't go well, half of the team will move forward, and we move forward to Polefish. So it wasn't a bad period or bad experience whatsoever.
So employees, of course, are the core of any business. In fact, they're the asset of the business, I have always argued. A contingent of our audience are from University of Georgia, Michigan State. It'd be great if you could talk to us a little bit about what you see as some key characteristics of an all-star employee and how that really impacts your business.
All-star employee. That question really depends with the timing that you're asking and the stage that the business is in. So at this point of time where we're, you know, running at 200 miles an hour, I think that the all-star employee is somebody who is extremely adaptive to changes. You know, we're going to do this. You know, we're doing this the first week. We don't see the results, so we're going to iterate immediately. So being able to handle that acceleration. And the other one is self-motivation. You know, doing so many things and being such a small company addressing such a big market, you need people to be self-motivated all the time. Down the road, maybe 1 or 2 years from now, that definition may change, right? You may have more people that can lead teams effectively and educate people and onboard people. But at this point of time, self-motivation and adaptiveness defines an all-star employee.
Yeah, I love that. I think just experientially, the adaptability is always been key. And then similarly, self-motivation. I mean, I've only managed a 400 person company, but you know, from that framework of 0 to 400, I'd say the people that have excelled are the ones that are always adding value, and that comes through, you know, above the standard deliverable. And that comes, I believe, at the core of just this innate desire to do better. And which is, to your point, you know, all about that motivation. That critical eye that employee provides on the work is, and then the communication and how that informs the broader organization is really vital, honestly.
I agree.
In fact, just kind of taking it a step further, sorry, kicking the horse, as it were, this concept of motivation and adaptability, it starts blurring the lines of responsibility a little bit, which can make people uncomfortable that like really strict guidelines. But that's where I have seen improvements to like gross margin, because people will reach outside of their specific deliverable in a project process and say, oh, if I got the information or the data in a slightly different format, then it would save me, you know, a certain amount of time. And so there, you know, that sort of that dialogue that happens, if it happens at an organic level, it can make all the difference in the world for a company.
Yeah. And I mean, any trait, if it's in a very exaggerated form, can be negative as well. So don't get me wrong. You need responsibility in there. You need communication. You need, you know, diligence from the employee to be a good employee. But if they have all this and they are also self-motivated and they, you know, do not provide an obstacle every single time the business is changing gears or direction, that's an all-star employee.
Absolutely right. And I think that's a point well taken, is you have to own your deliverables, your lanes, you know, what it is you have to get done in the context of budget and time. You're right. There is absolutely a ceiling and a floor to that framework for it to be successful. And I mean, the reality is, I think we all have and will continue, you know, to balance that to some degree. But I like that adaptability and self-motivation as core to an all-star employee. So you've built a very successful company. What is one of your secrets that drives your growth, profitability, or success?
I'm going to go back and answer this question the similar way I answered one of the previous questions. I think it's naivety. It's going back with a fresh perspective. And I'll give you very specific examples just to understand what I'm saying. When we, you know, the period we launched Polfis, the standard was panels and in-person, interviews. They still are. But there was a notion that you have to pay in some way, or, you know, a gift card or with actual money, the people that responded to the survey. That was the standard. And we didn't knew that. We didn't know that. And we went to the industry saying that what the consumer and the respondent values, it's not necessarily 30 cents per response or, you know, even $1. It's the experience they're getting. That's what they value the most. And so going in there and those things being very, you know, very native to us, you know, we did it. Yeah, and you don't expect from a yellow cab driver to invent Uber. That's, you know, all he knows is yellow cabs. They does that every day. Maybe he will invent a better yellow cab. But so coming from a very fresh perspective, we managed to change the dynamics and the unit economics of sampling. If we didn't pay the consumers, it actually happened. You know, did the calculations to do that. It actually happened. So without paying the consumers and only paying the channels that the consumers will have access to, and by giving the consumers native in-app experiences every single time they respond to a survey, we can pass that unit economics benefits back to the client and allow them to do research very cost-effectively. If we had to pay the consumers, that model is broken. And, you know, we also couldn't understand how the business, how a person could do 150 questions in one session. I have never done a survey like that. And if I was in the research space, you know, it would grow on me. I would say, all right, it happens. So we only in the beginning allowing people to do 12 questions, and then we increased that to 17 questions. And, you know, we lost a lot of clients because of that in the early days. But we were very stubborn, and coming from a different world and see that I like to think, saw the disadvantages of the market research space, and, you know, we take a completely fresh approach.
Know your assumptions, right? This point is my favorite thing that we've talked about. I take it for granted myself, and am guilty of it as anybody is. We need to understand what our core assumptions are and not assume that they are truth, because we're probably, to your point, missing the bigger picture. And that's why it's so important that we surround ourselves with people that are outside of our industry, that are widely diverse from us on a wide on as diverse of a perspective as you can get, because that's where we can start triangulating and then finding, you know, core truth.
I completely agree with that. Yes. It's a very hard thing to do. Once you think something, you know something, it's extremely easy, hard to accept the different way of thinking. So it's also a very hard thing to do as well.
So what is Polefish offering right now that's finding purchase in the marketplace and offering a lot of value to your customers?
So essentially it's three things. We allow our customers to tap into our survey network. It's a very big survey network that reaches 500 million consumers. And we allow them to do so in a self-serve manner. So we brought two things. We brought speed and cost effectiveness by, you know, not paying the end consumer, by paying the channels and implementing that new unit economics. And at the same time, we said that we will only allow you to use our service if you know what you're doing, if you can build the survey on your own. So, you know, that again is something that in 2013 nobody would do. So what we are representing is that we want to make extremely easy and no-brainer for a business to do research. So that has a lot to do with the cost and has a lot to do with the speed and the ease of use. And I think we're getting there. Maybe we played a very small role to it, and but the businesses are also want that today. So if you're, what are we doing now? If you're in a company and you have a question, it's a no-brainer to run a Polefish survey and have more insights for things that you wouldn't normally think to go out, pick up the phone and do, you know, a survey or run a survey campaign.
Does the SurveyMonkey IPO, did that get you guys pretty excited? I know today's an off day in the market, but...
Yeah, you picked the day. It's the first after a lot of time, right? And I don't think it's a secret that more will come. It's really nice to see how the markets react to market research, although it's a pretty different model in different industry. It's not on the sample side, it's more on the provider and the tools. I was very excited the day of the IPO. I actually went to Times Square to see the whole thing with the NASDAQ images there. But I think everybody in the industry is excited with that, to see how that will go.
Yeah, it'll be neat to watch them. And then Qualtrics, of course, coming out sooner rather than later, I believe.
Right. Yep. That's my prediction as well.
My guest today has been John Papadakis, CEO of Polefish. John, thank you so much for being on the Happy Market Research Podcast.
Thank you so much for inviting me, and I enjoyed very much the conversation.
Next time on the Happy Market Research Podcast, Bailey Buchanan, Research for Good, she'll be talking about the benefits of being a missions-driven organization, both internally and externally. Hope you'll join us then.